As you've probably heard by now, we've teamed up with BetMGM this season. We'll be using BetMGM lines to make all of our picks, and we'll have special offers for our listeners each week. If you haven't signed up for BetMGM yet, use bonus code THEATHLETIC, and you'll get a one-year subscription to The Athletic, plus up to a $1,500 first bet offer on your first wager with BetMGM. Here's how it works. Download the BetMGM app and sign up using bonus code THEATHLETIC. Make your first deposit of at least $10, place your first bet on any game, and claim your voucher for a one-year subscription to The Athletic. See BetMGM.com for terms. U.S. promotional offers not available in D.C., Mississippi, New York, Nevada, Ontario, or Puerto Rico. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER. Available in the U.S. Call 877-8-HOPE-NY or text HOPE-NY-467-369 in New York. Call 1-800-NEXT-STEP in Arizona. 1-800-327-5050 in Massachusetts. 1-800-BETS-OFF in Iowa. 1-800-270-7117 for confidential help in Michigan. 1-800-981-0023 in Puerto Rico. First bet offer for new customers only in partnership with Kansas Crossing Casino and Hotel. Don't forget, if you haven't signed up for BetMGM yet, use bonus code THEATHLETIC and you'll get a one-year subscription to The Athletic, plus up to a $1,500 first bet offer on your first wager.
The only way to score is, of course, to play with a hand break off.
Hello, I'm Ian Stone. This is Handbreak Off, the Arsenal podcast brought to you by The Athletic. I'm joined by The Athletic writer, Amy Lawrence, and the former Arsenal player and regular on the podcast, Mr. Lee Dixon. Hello, guys.
Hello. Morning.
I Hello, much preferred morning. Your previous introduction that we've had to cut.
I was just thinking about, you know, those when they have those scenes in films of like extras where everybody's just cracking up and they can't do the scene because someone's done it and said or done something. Every time they do a new take, everyone's killing themselves.
Yes.
As you were doing that perfectly legitimate intro, I was sitting here giggling, thinking, well,
"Me too."
No cameras.
Well, I'm sorry, listener. You're never going to hear what that is because it's wrong in every sense. That other intro, but anyway, I'm holding in my hand a copy of the book Arsene Wenger: My Life in Red and White, my autobiography, and we're going to talk about that. Amy, I should say by disclosure, Lee, have you read this? By the way, have you read it?
No.
And I have, no. You're in it, though. I would say that. I did look up your name.
Bloody hope so.
Yeah, you are. You are. Yeah, I mean, I did look up. There might not be as many mentions as you'd have hoped. I mean, I don't know what you were hoping for, to be honest. You're in there, though. You're in there.
I'm quite pleased. Lots of the reasons for him to talk about me are not in the book, so.
Well, we'll get into it.
I'm just looking at the index as we speak, Lee. You're in three separate pages, so there's that. Which on either side of you, you've got discipline, which is mentioned five times. So you're not quite up there with discipline. And Yuri Djorkaeff, who gets two pages, so you're sandwiched between discipline and Yuri Djorkaeff.
Yeah,
that makes me feel great.
That is purely alphabetical, though, isn't it? Can I just... I mean, it's not because Lee Dixon was disciplined. Or that, anyway, what we're gonna talk about, although you were, obviously, as a player, we are going to get into the meat of the book and we're going to talk about his career and also his legacy as well. Amy, you have read the book.
I have, yes.
I only got it yesterday afternoon. So I've skimmed it, I'll be honest with you. I've had a look at a few bits. There was no Ian Stone in the index. I was very, very upset about that. But, one of our best fans. But
there's no ghostwriter, but I'm not bitter.
No. Was there anything, Amy, I'll start with you, our little question that we like to do at the start. Was there anything in the book that you'd love to have seen, that you'd love to have heard about, that he didn't put in? Because he was quite careful, I believe, in some of the things he said.
To think carefully about how to answer this. There's loads more I'd like to know. There's definitely room for a sequel. In fact, I think overall, oh great, I've used the Wengerism straight away. I believe that this book is great. However, what's really interesting from a perspective of Arsenal is that possibly the Arsenal sections are not the best bits of the book, which considering it was 22 years of his life's work, and his undying passion. And it's very, very clear when you read the book how deep in love with his job and that club, and how much it hurt at times, how much he suffered, and how much it probably still hurts him to this day. I think he said at one point that he and David Dean, who are still very good friends, David Dean obviously brought him to the club, that they, these men of football who gave so much in their period together, building up the club to a very special period, still every day, more or less, talk about Arsenal without being able to act on it. And it's a very, very strange sensation, I think, to have that huge connection, which is intact, but feel quite powerless with it. And Arsene made it clear that he's like, the only way he felt in a sense that he could deal with it is like ripping off the plaster and not, you know, not having any contact. Whereas, say, David Dean still goes to matches and is still sort of around. Arsene, it's a bit too raw for him. But you can feel how much it all meant to him. Having said that, the stuff I really, really enjoyed most, in a way, was about his childhood and about the things that formed him and formed his management, and growing up in this little village, and how he developed to become this incredibly single-minded and successful master of his trade on a global stage, and the things that he experienced along the way, be it in France or in Japan, when he first arrived in England. In many ways, the human stuff is in many ways more interesting than the football stuff, because it's not, the football stuff is less detailed. It's not a sort of warts and all, you know, here's all those stories. He used to say to us in press conferences, get asked a difficult question, and he'd say, oh, you'll have to wait for my book for that. And but yeah, he hasn't written that kind of book. It's not a tell-all type at all. It's more of a kind of a sense of what it takes to go from nothing, a little, you know, working village where people worked the land and went to the pub where he grew up and played for the local team and had a very simple life. There wasn't a great deal for him to sort of learn about life within the confines of his village, and not many people left, and he did, and he became this man of the world. And that's what I think is really fascinating.
I mean, it was interesting. I wasn't expecting, I read the first chapter, and I wasn't expecting horses and blacksmiths and farms and all the rest of it. But I guess that was where he grew up, and it was a very, very different world. Lee, is there anything you would like to ask Arsene? It's possibly they are answered in the books, but are there any questions that you had through your career or even afterwards when you thought, you know what, I'd love to know what he thought about that?
Well, I think probably the most selfish first question I'd ask is why he didn't give me another year. I was, because me and Tony decided to retire in 2002, and I just, you know, if he'd have come up with a little plan of saying, well, why don't you just stay in the dressing room and be around the place? I certainly think there's a position for something like that with some of the ex-players, some of the ex-talent, some of the knowledge that you've got at club. Is almost, you know, the doors open on the last day and you walk out. And I don't know. I think maybe perhaps I would have liked to have been asked to stay in some capacity. Now, that's probably, you know, my ego going, well, you know, I've done this, I've done that. Maybe I should feel wanted. But Arsene wasn't like that with, you know, he certainly wasn't like that with Tony. He wasn't, you know, he wasn't necessarily that encouraging when it came to life after football. Now, I don't know why that is, and I don't know why I felt the need to be wanted by him, maybe because I respected him so much. And, you know, I kind of, at the end of it, maybe I should have took the lead and said, no, I want to stay in a role in the club. What is there on offer? I never said that. I just kind of needed a break and left, and never went back. So there's a regret from my point of view a little bit, to be honest with you. I'm still involved a little bit commercially with the club, and I'm still welcome back there. But I do feel as if there's part of me still there, that I've got unfinished business, and I don't know what that business is. But I, you know, that would be something I would sit down and chat with him at some point if we ever had a coffee in that respect. But he's, from the book's point of view, I mean, you know, I haven't read it. I will read it. Although, you know, with Amy saying what she said, I'd be interested in the all the stuff going on with his childhood and how he grew up. That would really interest me because I don't know that story.
Yes.
But the rest of it, you know, if he's skirting around issues and it's not a warts, you know, it doesn't have to be a warts and all. But I think, you know, I know all the stuff and nonsense. It's the bits in between that, and I know of that. I want to hear his version of events that went on at the club that he left. So the club that he loved so much. And yet there was, you know, he was tainted when he left. There's no doubt about that. I want to know the ins and outs of that.
It's interesting hearing you sound quite sentimental, Lee, if I may say. And one thing that does come out of the book is it is quite pragmatic, which is a lot of what football is about, isn't it? Let's be fair.
Yeah, I think so. And I just think that the one thing that lingers with me is the sadness that when he left, there was a relief, I think, from his point of view at the end.
And ours.
And I think he realised he'd stayed too long.
Yeah.
But ultimately, when he talks about the club now, you know, he loves the club, but he's got no, you know, a man like that, like Sir Alex Ferguson, and has got connections with United still, he surely still should have something to do with the club based on what he did there.
This episode is supported by FX's Welcome to Wrexham. Celebrity owners Rob McElhenney and Ryan Reynolds' small-town Welsh football club has finally been promoted into League 2 after 15 seasons in the National League. Dedicated staff and supporters celebrate the city's return to glory while bracing for the newfound challenges that come with being in a higher league. Will Wrexham AFC stand up to the challenge and rise again into League 1? FX's Welcome to Wrexham premieres May 2nd on FX, stream on Hulu.
Looking for an assist with your credit card but can't get a hold of anyone? Luckily, with 24/7 US-based live customer service from Discover, everyone has the option to talk to a real person anytime, day or night. Yep, you heard that right. You can talk to a real human in customer service at any time. Sounds like a real game changer if you ask us. Make the right call and get the service you deserve with Discover. Limitations apply. See terms at discover.com/creditcard.
Then we played a little bit with a handbrake.
I asked my son, Alexander, who is a regular Arsenal fan and has been since he was about 4 or 5, what he would ask Arsene Wenger. But his actual words were, why didn't you buy a goalkeeper? And, I mean, he's only 4, but he's very advanced. But I think it was a perfectly valid question for someone, Amy, who's such a pragmatist as Arsene Wenger. There seem to be quite a lot of blind spots in some of his player recruitment and also how loyal he was to players.
Yeah, I mean, I think those two things are linked. And I agree with you on the blind spots. And I think that was, I don't know why, and probably it's a flaw in myself to even say this, but sometimes I used to find that his flaws or his blind spots, although they drove me mad, I kind of, in a weird way, I quite liked them as part of him. I mean, he's such an interesting character. He's such an intriguing brain and human being to see. You know, you've seen so much of his immense intellectual capability. And for someone that brilliant to have these characteristics, which either manifest itself in, you know, not buying a goalkeeper, but equally can manifest itself in, you know, the famous story of having his spinoffy pie on his plate and just not noticing that it had fallen off and gone. You know, the sort of the contrast, if you like, between his absolute brainy brilliance and those moments where you think, how can you be that clever and have such a blind spot? And that always sort of interested me. And in a way, people's complexities make them more interesting.
Just a point of correction. It was cheesecake.
Can I briefly diverge into Matas Canteen? And this really was one of the revelations of the book for me and one of my favourite lines, where he turned around and said, I'm really not that keen on broccoli.
What? He force fed it to everyone else.
Well, right. Yeah. I never saw my mum eat broccoli, but she always used to throw it down our necks. So maybe she came from the same school as our son.
Hey, whatever. It seemed to work.
I think he was kind of surprised that it became this sort of symbol of like, oh, our son and the broccoli, you know.
Yeah.
Right.
The alcohol and the chocolate bars, and he gave them broccoli, and he's like, well, I'm really not that keen on broccoli. And I'm like, Jesus.
Righty was very vocal about the broccoli, to be fair. I mean, I've heard him speak about it on many occasions. So let's talk about when he arrived. Lee, you were there. You're an established player in the team. They'd won trophies. This chap walks in the door, the professor, as... was that your nickname, by the way, in the team, or was that generally the press who came up with that?
No, it was. I mean, he did look like a school teacher, but I think the press, you know, labelled him the professor because he looked like a professor. But you know, to me, he was like my geography teacher. That's the vision I had when I first saw him, and with his studious glasses and his, you know, leather arm pads on his elbows.
Did he actually have those, or is that your geography teacher?
No, I just completely made that up. But it's, in my vision of him, when I close my eyes, that's how I see him. All of a sudden, he's got leather patches on his elbows.
Yeah.
But that's the kind of character he seemed to me. Very, very quietly spoken. And I never forget the first time he stood us all round outside at London Coney before we trained, and then stretched again. He said to me, he started talking to the players, and I was like, well, he's got absolutely no chance. I'd already written him off because I was like, I couldn't even hear him. He was quietly spoken. He was saying, you know, in this very soft, considered voice with an amazing, soft, lovely accent. And I was like, well, that ain't going to work, is it? Well, you know, we literally just come from Bruce Rioch, who, you know, he was tried to speak quietly to the lads. And then, but his default position was, you know, trying to have a fight with John Artson in the corner of the changing room. So, and then before that, obviously George, who had his moments with his voice raising. But I just, that was the thing that stood out for me, was that I don't believe that he's going to be able to manage a team of, yeah, experienced winners, if you like, to a certain extent. How's he going to cope with the times when he's going to have to start throwing a few teacups around? And we soon learned that that wasn't his style, and there was another way of doing it. And it was like, wow, didn't realise that you could actually talk your way through a half time. You know, it was completely different.
Lee, I mean, I've heard you talk quite a lot on this podcast about when you sort of realised, you know, when you did all the pre-season training and you thought we're not going to be fit enough. And then we, you know, suddenly the team were outstanding when they first got on the pitch and you went, hello. So that was the point when you thought, OK, this might work. Amy, from a fan's point of view, I mean, you saw him arrive. How long did it take before you thought, oh, no, he is the real deal?
Well, I might be cute here and suggest that it was before, when Patrick Vieira appeared on that famous debut against Sheffield Wednesday. And I think everyone was so stunned, and it was obvious that this player had come because of Arsene. He was kind of an advanced notice of the ideas and principles, I think, that would come. And everyone looked at each other and just went, what on earth is this? It's incredible. So I think that was a real moment of excitement. But likely, like everybody, nobody knew much about what to expect. And I think there was a really interesting point when his first game, where he wasn't actually official Arsenal manager, but he was there, was at Borussia Mönchengladbach. In fact, the game was played in Cologne, a UEFA Cup game. And Arsenal lost that match, and I think he came down at half time.
He did. I'm just looking.
Change formation.
Yes.
And it didn't work. And I think he took Tony Adams off, actually.
He did.
Which is a slightly controversial move. And, you know, it was what I find most interesting. I don't know about when a specific moment happened. Perhaps if I was to think of a game that summed up a feeling of this is really a zeitgeist moment of kind of, you felt like something was changing right before your eyes and in a fascinating way, was his first North London derby. And it was in an absolute chucking down rain. Jerry Francis had his, you know, trademark mullet getting wet on the touchline. Tottenham were a bit cheaty and got a goal that was a bit naughty because the ball had gone out of play for someone to get treatment and they didn't throw it back and went and attacked and scored a jammy equaliser. It was an absolutely belting match, and Bergkamp scored a wonderful goal, a great knee slide celebration. Wrighty also scored, and he did his put his shirt over his head with "I love the lads" on his t-shirt. It was a very emotional day, and Wenger was kind of shaking his fists while this was all going on, and you know, from the sidelines as he was getting drenched. And what it was to me at the time was a team that was right before your eyes. The evidence was there of this transformation of some of a blend of all the old values, all the old British values, embodied by Lee and everybody that he grew up with in that team, and kind of also having the sort of Vieira and Bergkamp and the continental flourish and the different sort of technical sophistication that was coming in with those types of players and with Arsene. And it was seeing that fusing together in a great game, in a kind of classically British thunderous match, that I think I came away from that and thought, this is special.
There's quite a lot of things in this book that he hasn't talked about. I mean, we've, to a certain extent, as you said, Amy, we've been waiting for this book to come out. You know, there's so many times in the press conferences when he said, oh, you'll have to read about it in the book. And now the book has come out, and as it said, it's not a warts and all. Lee, I mean, the fact that it's not a warts and all book, are you a little bit disappointed by that fact? I mean, I know no. you haven't read it, but no, would you have liked to have seen something a little bit more sharp-edged, perhaps?
No, I don't. I'm not a big believer in warts and all books anyway. I think, you know, that's one of the reasons why I haven't written a book, is I'm not prepared to, you know, my life in football, I can tell different stories and that are equally as interesting as sitting there and starting to slag off people in my past and then expose some of the things that went on or went on with me that I've got no interest in sharing with other people. So I think I wouldn't like him to have come out and started to jeopardise some of his relationships or whatever by doing a warts and all book. But I think from what makes a good book, and in my humble opinion, is what makes a good book and a not so good book, and I'm not making judgment yet, although I'm leaning towards I'd like to see a little bit more of him in it as opposed to you know, him skirting round and, you know, showing us stats or whatever. I think a good book is telling somebody something they don't know. And it's the same with doing what I do on TV, is tell, you know, if I can see something analytically in a game that I'm watching, or I can say something on screen to people at home that they have no clue or knowing unless I tell them. It doesn't make it right or wrong. It just means it's a bit of information you couldn't possibly know, i.e. some of the things that go on in a dressing room or some insight that you've picked up through the years that they couldn't possibly tell. No, I think that's good information, and I think you could write a book like that. There's so much stuff with Arsene because he's such a complex character. There's so, you know, every single person who say got a 10-minute interview with Arsene would ask him different question. You know, they would ask. He's such a fascinating guy and a conversationalist that if he did a book that was a bit thin, then I'd be massively disappointed. And, you know, as I said, I'm not making judgment now, but it sounds like it's something that he's done, and maybe with a view to doing another one. I don't know, but it probably wouldn't be the book if me and him were Mr. and Mrs. Honest and sat down and went, right, let's do a book, me and you, Arsene, and write, and it wasn't published, and we just write a book based on our relationship and what in football, then that would be worth reading. But, you know, I think he's stepped back from that a little bit.
I think what you said at the start there, Lee, was really telling, and your sentiments to say I wouldn't really want to expose honestly details of things that happen with people and relationships and so on. I think it's really, really obvious that Arsene felt similarly. So I think that has arced and played a role in the conflict.
But Amy, don't you think? Don't you think then if that's not the case, if you're not willing to do the warts and all and tell the story, because the big question is going to be asked, then take control of the situation and write a book about a subject that you don't have to do that. And there's a million subjects,
but
I think what makes him a winner? How did I become a winner?
Not Alex Ferguson did that,
didn't he? In there, and that's what I said. That's the stuff that I think is really compelling. And even when he does talk about his time at Arsenal and some of the particular challenges, I think there are lots of elements where he's explaining and he's trying to, you know, rationalise, and sometimes with hindsight and sometimes explaining how things were at the time. It's just not in forensic detail, and the reason it's not in forensic detail is for exactly the reasons you say, which is that I think he's a man of integrity and dignity and wouldn't want to be the type of person ever who's sort of washing any dirty linen in public. That is just not his personality, and nor does it need to be. It doesn't mean it's not a book where you don't come away and think. I think there's a lot you gain about his thoughts, processes, and how he deals with information, how he deals with personalities, how he deals with all the myriad different problems and the solutions that you need to find when you're a manager of a massive football club and you're in a competitive environment every day of your life. So there is a lot in there that touches on those themes. But it's not necessarily done in such a way that says, here's an example and let me tell you exactly what happened in, you know, the Nicholas and Elka transfer, or
which I think people will be disappointed about. I mean, there seems to be a lot of omissions. No mention of Mourinho in this book,
Why? I'm glad he didn't.
Well, because we'd like to know about one of the most interesting and complex, a word you've both been using quite a lot this morning, complex relationships that he had.
It's not a relationship he had or wanted. I'm glad he didn't talk about Mourinho.
Lee, do you feel the same way about this?
No, I think we've got, it's exactly what I just said before about this. When you're writing a book, I think you've got to pick the subject at the start of it and go, what am I writing this book for?
It's called What's My Life about? In Red and White, yeah, right? This is about his time as manager at Arsenal. And
not
one
just
of the things
Arsenal,
no, it's
all
not
his
Arsenal,
clubs were red
all
and white.
All his clubs
okay.
were red and white. So,
okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
So he's talking about his life at those clubs in red and white. So somewhere along that journey, if you're writing a book about that, what happened at Arsenal after Monaco, etc., then you surely then have to talk about the subjects that are interesting and stand out about that. Don't call it that subject and write about your time in red and white if you're not going to talk about your time in red and white. And the interesting thing to a fan or to a reader is if he's going to talk about Arsenal, then there is a timeline and there's certain incidents and occasions that absolutely have to talk about. If you skirt around those and don't talk about them, then it then becomes a thin book. And I sound like a book critic, and I'm not, because
it's all right.
All I, from his point of view, I would much prefer to read a book about what his philosophy is. The whole thing, maybe do a diary or how do you manage Arsenal Football Club, and how do you become a winner from where he got. And I know Amy said you go through his childhood and then it goes through a bit of a timeline getting to where he is now. But if you're not going to put anything in the pages in between, then what's the point? Pick a subject and just extensively write about that subject.
Yes, I mean, like I say, from the little I've read of it, I do wonder. I mean, it's almost about inference, isn't it? Some of the omissions that he's had, you have to infer what he might think about people from that. And but that to me feels like a lot of his press conferences in the last 10 years when he didn't say what he actually felt. I mean, Amy, how much is there in the book? And like I say, you're the only one of us who's read the whole thing. How much is there about his leaving and about how he felt? I mean, I know there's stuff at the start, but I mean, we can say that he was asked to leave, right? I think that's fair enough. And for a man, for a proud man like that, and for we know how much love he's got for the club. And after that Man City game, when there were 25,000 turned up and we got spanked, it seems that Josh Kroenke said to him, you're going to have to leave or we're going to have to sack you. And how much of that is in the book?
Well, it's not in forensic detail, but what there is a lot of his response and emotional reaction to, you know, what happened to him. And it's really obvious. I found it almost like quite sad to read that.
Of course.
Because you could feel his hurt through the pages. You could feel his hurt through the words. And again, he's not the type of person to turn around and say, I felt betrayed. That somebody else might in a similar
tell-all type thing,
book. But that's not his way. But you could sort of sense it. You could sense that he thought, look, I've given my life for every waking hour for 22 years and I've sacrificed, you know, friendships, family, time, all that kind of stuff that comes with the territory of when you're that kind of job with that kind of dedication. But I think he was, and also because he's always set great store and trying to do things properly, and that's really obvious. He talks, one of the words that comes up again and again and again in the book is rigour. He talks about doing things with rigour. His sense of hard, honest work, which again probably goes back to the people he looked up to when he was growing up. It's really massively strong in him. It's almost something that relates him more to those great, epic Scottish managers of, you know, that came out of Glasgow and the working class sort of areas that were very deprived in sort of Jock Stein and Shankly and Busby and so on. It's something that connects, I think, him and his philosophy more to that kind of person, those kind of ideas, than some of the more modern managers that we get today, even though he's not long since retired, which again gives you that sense of where he stands in history, really. Because of his sense of doing things properly, I think he felt that maybe he was treated a little bit improperly in the end. And he doesn't say it outright, but you can infer it.
Lee, from an ex-player's point of view, and as you said at the start of this podcast, you were quite upset when he let you go, but it was a sort of pragmatic decision. I mean, do you think the club made the right decision, and do you think he doesn't really have a right to feel aggrieved by what happened? That's a very leading question, by the way.
I think if you know, in all honesty, if he came around for a cup of tea, he doesn't know where I live, I've moved, so I hope he doesn't go to the old house. Okay. If he came round...
You're taking this very literally, but okay, let's imagine that he did.
If he came round for a cup of tea and we sat down about his time at Arsenal, and I would ask the question, do you think you maybe stayed too long? It's been inferred by lots of ex-players and pundits alike, and we've all got opinion because that's what we pay to do. In all honesty, I think he would say the same thing. I think he would say, in hindsight, but he's such an intelligent guy, but he's so emotionally attached to the club and the thought process that he can change something into a better thing because he's done it most of his footballing career, that staying another year, I can sort it out, you know, that sort of reluctance to give up in that respect was to his detriment in the end. And I think it's probably something that ties in with his winning mentality, that he just didn't want to go to that place and he thought one more year would do it. But I thought he stayed too long, and I think he would say the same. And with that becomes the sadness.
I don't know if his upset is that he didn't get the extra year. I think it's that it came out mid-season.
No, I didn't say that, Amy. I don't think he got an extra year. I think he, in his mind, he always thought he could change it around, and that's why he probably stayed too long. That was my point, sorry.
Did he talk about Ivan Gazidis, by the way, at all, Amy, in the book? And did he talk about that relationship and how that worked? Because I think that part of the team's problems maybe in the last couple of years, and we might talk briefly about Mesut Ozil's £8 million loyalty bonus... Sorry, I'm just something stuck in my throat. I'm going to be sick. But these things that are going on now are partly a legacy of that relationship.
Yeah, there's not a great deal about Ivan Gazidis. And if anything, there are moments where you draw some pretty good conclusions if you want to read between the lines on perhaps what he thought of how that ended up.
I don't want to read between the lines. I want to read the lines. That's what I'd like to read. I've been waiting to read the lines for a long time. But okay, I understand
your inference. Challenging you to read between the lines.
Yeah, I know. I don't need challenging. I'm happy as...
We've got nothing else to do at the moment.
Fair point. I've got gigs that aren't occurring that I'm turning up at, and we can so talk
tell
about...
Tell us about last
briefly,
night.
Briefly, I went to a gig last night that actually is happening next Tuesday, and I felt like an idiot. I've got to be honest.
So quite literally, see you next Tuesday. Sorry, walked into that.
That's really funny, Amy. All right, fair enough. I didn't realise I was going to get heckled the next morning. It didn't even happen. By the way, briefly, before we move on, Arsene's given a couple of lovely, twinkly interviews on various outlets, on Radio 4 and what have you, and he was talking about some of the rule changes that he's trying to bring in with in his new role as technical director at FIFA. Lee, one of the things he was talking about was you don't have to throw in throw-ins anymore. That's what he'd like, just kick it in, because he was saying that you're essentially at a disadvantage. Now, you took a lot of throw-ins to the Arsenal. Do you think that's a fair point?
It's an interesting one, because that takes me back to one of my games with Graham Taylor over in, I think we were in Poland playing the final qualifier, and we had to get a draw with Poland to qualify. And Graham Taylor said, bless his soul, he said, right, if we win the toss, we roll the ball back to Andy Gray, who was making his debut, I think, the Aston Villa Andy Gray. We roll it back to Andy Gray, and I want you to kick it straight out of play near the corner flag. His first touch in English football as an international, they told him to kick it out of play right down the corner flag. And we all went, why are we doing that? He said, what happens then? He said, you immediately, you're 11v11 at kickoff. As soon as you kick the ball out of play, it becomes 11v10 because they have to take a man off the pitch. This was Graham Taylor back in the early 90s. And he said, we then start the game in a throw-in. They're under pressure. They've got 10 men. You're playing against 10 men. They have to throw it in near their, in their last third. We win possession. We're in better position than we were at kickoff. And Gary Lineker looked at him and went, are you kidding me? He said, hang on a minute. What has the game come to? And, you know, maybe he was way ahead of his time because, you know, that's what happens. You go down to 10 men. That's a little story connected to that. What do I think of it? Not a big fan, to be honest with you. What you want, you then get to kick it in.
Essentially, you get to stand at the side, the ball goes out, you get it, and you just kick it to a player and you carry on.
I think that's only from your own half.
Is that right?
I was going to say, because it all becomes it becomes corners everywhere then, doesn't it? If you do it like that. Yeah.
Oh, I see.
Because if you got a throw in halfway in that final third, you just lump it in the box, can't you? Mind you, having said that, you're looking in, you could, in theory, you know, get Edison as your goalkeeper to take all the throw ins in your own half and it becomes a corner.
Well, yes, that is true. I'm not sure that he considered that, but I suppose, I mean, the other thing he was talking about was when you get a free kick, just take it, you just kick it to yourself and carry on. His basic ideas, I believe. Amy, were trying to quicken the game up to adapt to the fact that there are athletes playing the game now. And I'm not, this is no disparagement to you, Lee, because you were an athlete.
Behaviour.
No, but you know what I'm saying, that the game is quicker now. And when you know, there's so many tactical fails and teams try and stop the other team playing. If you can just kick it to yourself and carry on, that negates that, does it not?
Yeah, I mean, I think the things that he suggested are all sort of relatively rational and relatively low key. They're not going to be as decisive a change as, VAR and things like that. But I mean, I'd rather that he spent some time sorting out sort of handball and offside and things like that to simplify those things and maybe speed the game up. Personally, I don't think that football needs to be scared of innovation and rule change as long as they're well thought out. And I would much rather someone like Arsene was involved in those discussions than perhaps some of the other people who have previously been in these committees, because at least you know that Arsene should really have a very good handle on anything that he's trying to change and why and what the pros and cons are. But if you look back to the banishment of the tackle from behind, which, you know, famously Marco van Basten ended his career early despite, you know, him being one of the all-time great players, and he was just hacked to bits in Serie A. And, you know, that was, at the time, you know, there was obviously a resistance to it because it was changing something that had been the same way forever. And there were some people who didn't think it was a good idea. And all these years later, you wouldn't turn around and go, I wish we had the tackle from behind back. That was a good innovation.
Well, yeah, that's a matter of opinion. It's a matter of opinion.
Lee, well, all the time you were talking about the tackle from behind there, Lee was just quietly weeping. And I used to love doing that.
I've just taken the dog out twice. I've just been tackling the dog, just practicing. But if you just go back to the back pass rule, was the best rule change that's ever been made. And when that was made, it was like we, as a back four, we were like, well, what are we going to do now? That's horrendous. And certainly from Liverpool's point of view, they were the best at keeping the ball at the back. And Alan Hansen, how many times he rolled that back to Grobbelaar, it was so frustrating. And when they changed that, it was like the whole football was going to, you know, come tumbling down because we couldn't pass it back to the keeper. And it was an absolutely brilliant law change.
This episode is brought to you by Michelob Ultra, the official beer sponsor of the NBA. Want to get closer to the game than ever before? Michelob Ultra Courtside is giving fans the chance to win exclusive NBA prizes and experiences like official gear, courtside seats to an NBA game, and more. Head over to MichelobUltra.com/courtside to learn more.
Then we played a little bit with a handbrake.
This is the Handbrake Off Arsenal podcast for The Athletic. Ian Stone here with Lee Dixon and Amy Lawrence. Briefly, we'll talk about a couple of pieces that have appeared in The Athletic in the last few days. David Ornstein did a piece where he mentions, as I said earlier, Mesut Ozil getting an £8 million loyalty bonus. I mean, I personally, as one of the 45,000 or so season ticket holders, are very glad to give my £200 to Mesut Ozil, because let's be fair, he has been loyal. This is just, Lee, this is just really a relic of a more desperate time at Arsenal, isn't it?
Well, yeah. I mean, if it's written into a contract, there's no getting out of it. So whether it should have been written in the first place is... You can talk about that.
Ivan Gazidis.
Well, there's the name. There's the name. We were just mentioning this. I mean, it's lax, isn't it? It's lax because this is... The fans are not going to pay for all of this, but we are going to pay for a bit of it.
Well, the club's paying for it. I don't know how you... I mean, at the moment, no one's bloody playing for anything except possibly some pay-per-view games. It's... I think it's a difficult time to be analysing finances, but I think as Lee said, it's in the contract. It was the price of that contract has felt heavier as the time goes by, that and the relationship worsens. It's hard to know where to go really anymore with this. It's just like a waiting game for it to be all over for me now. You know, I struggle sometimes with when people get too much into the analysing how much something's worth in financial terms in football. You know, you get loads of money, so therefore you've got to be able to take abuse. You get loads of money, so therefore fans can't relate to you or can relate. It's all I get a bit mixed up with this, because I kind of think if someone's willing to pay you something to do your job, that's one thing, and then how well you are as a footballer is sort of something else.
Well, all those rational opinions about players' wages and all, they all went out the window years ago, when we could actually, you know, to be able to relate to somebody getting a, as Tony Adams says, a fair day's pay for a fair day's work, like his dad always used to say to him. All those little sayings that you... All of that's gone out the window, because the actual value of a player is so mixed up now, and how much he gets, and there's transfer fees. And how so money's rocketed to a place that none of us can understand. So to actually try and work out, as you said, Amy, what worth is, it's impossible. So you just don't, when things like that come up, you almost get to the point of go, I don't care anymore. I don't care what he's getting. I don't care what the club, it's just done, because it's something that we can't all relate to.
Lee, while you're thinking about this subject, I totally understand the point you're making, but this idea we've heard recently about Project Big Picture, or Bigger Piece of Pie.
We haven't got time for this.
Do you have a brief thought as to your view about what seems to be making the league more uncompetitive?
I'm still going through it. I think there's lots of pluses for it, and there's a huge amount of minuses for it. So to come down on either side right now, my initial thought is I'm scared of it. But because obviously I played at the lower leagues and I want, you know, but then I think, well, they're going to get a load more money. So that's a good thing. And every time I read a different thing, I go, well, it's good then. Or is it bad? There's so many. And I think that's the Trojan horse analogy that's been bandied around kind of sits with me a little bit more comfortably at the moment. But then tomorrow I might change my mind. So it's a real can of worms. It really is.
Amy, we're one of the big six, or big nine, if you count Everton, Southampton and West Ham, who have been included in this deal for some reason. It benefits us, doesn't it? Or does the lack of competitive element hurt us as much as the lower league teams?
Good question. I'm just uncomfortable with it. I just think that there's something really simple about sporting endeavour, which is that you win and you do well and you profit and you mess up and it goes backwards. And if you're kind of gonna mess around too much with that very fundamental idea, that I just don't like it. I think that there's a principle. I like the idea that, particularly in this period of need where we're all living through very, very strange times, I like the idea that football as a whole kind of come up with something to protect and preserve the soul of the game in this country, and that includes lots of smaller clubs that don't have access to many resources and maybe don't have that massive fan base or, you know, but are hugely vital to their local communities in the same way that Arsenal is vital to its community here in M5. And yeah, I'm all for getting together and trying to work something out that helps everyone as much as possible through this period and maybe beyond. But let's not mess around with the fundamentals of sport and sporting achievement and possibility. You've got to have possibility in sport, otherwise what's the point?
Quite. Yeah. Now, for a limited time only, we're offering you the chance to subscribe to The Athletic for just £1 a month. You can read all of our writing on Arsenal and so much more. Just go to theathletic.com/ArsenalPod to sign up. That's theathletic.com/ArsenalPod and sign up for just £1 a month. Can we have a song before you go? Lee, you often don't hang around for the song, but you're here at the moment. Do we have a song
I've got
perhaps Arsene Wenger?
Yeah, Bat Out of Hell. Meatloaf.
Okay.
I always say that, but it actually is quite apt because he is a bat out of hell. He's beyond his time. Look at him flourishing now as the FIFA head of football.
He does look well, doesn't he? There's no doubt.
He looks great, doesn't he?
He does. 60, whatever. No, 71 or something. Amy, do you have a song?
Yeah, well, like a lot of people, they've, you know, seeing Arsene lately, hearing him and reading him. And also, I mean, I know we talked to just briefly a lot about how he wrote the book, but him to have actually written it himself is quite amazing. I'm not sure how many people would have done that. So I'm going to go for Everything But The Girl, Miss You.
Oh,
nice. Oh. Tao, our producer, suggested a Kim Sims tune from the early 90s, Too Blind to See It, which I quite like. I was going to have Edith Piaf, Je Ne Regrette Rien.
God, I think that might be your first musical selection win ever.
Yeah. Well, thank you for patronising me. I appreciate it.
Anytime, mate.
This has been a Handbrake off the Arsenal podcast for The Athletic. Thank you to Lee Dixon and Amy Lawrence, and thank you to Tao, our producer. I'm Ian Stone. Stay safe.